The Senate Judiciary Committee is called to order. We have a quorum to conduct business consisting of myself, Senator McGuire, Senator Coghill, and Senator Costello. We have three items on the agenda today: Senate Bill 23, Senate Bill 82, and HCR 3. For Senate Bill 23, the sponsor is Senator Ellis. He's here in person, but we do have someone online, Dr. Paula Colescott, who is working on the bill, and she just has 15 minutes before she boards a flight, so the sponsor has graciously agreed to defer to Dr. Colescott. So, Dr. Colescott, are you there? If you put your name on the record and offer testimony.
Thank you. My name is Paula Colescott. I'm a physician here who's pursuing an addiction. I'm leading a conference here in Atlanta, the American Association for the Treatment of Opiate Problems, and I have some interesting news that I'd like to just share very briefly with you folks. Since 2009, and I'm sure you probably know this, but there have been types of drug overdoses have primarily been the prescription opiate for heroin. And these unintentional deaths now exceed motor vehicle accidents. And it's parallel with the use of prescription opiates, which since 1999 up to 2010 was really quadrupled. And with that, the death rate has just been right in step with that. And what's happened is that there's been a response in the state, very state, throughout the country, that came to this conference and talked about this, and commenting that we really haven't seen this kind of mortality in the area of opiates since the AIDS epidemic. And the one speaker who is responsible for starting Project Lazarus.org, out of North Carolina, we had four times over the national.
We lost her. Okay. Okay, well, and you know what we'll do is we will see if we can get some written. It looks like it sounded like she was reading from something, so we
and
could
she supports the bill.
Excellent. Okay, so Senator Ellis, I think that was clear.
Well, I would say cut her off.
Oh, welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for hearing Senate Bill 23 today. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis representing Senate District J. I'll give a few brief remarks, and then if it pleases the committee, I'll turn it over to my staffer, Matt Moser. My notes originally said Amory LaLake, yes. My staffer who's done the bulk of the work on this legislation, but Matt will take us on a walkthrough. Amory sends her best. She's doing well. Thank you for your role in helping get her and your staff for helping get her some health care. She's doing well, and we send our love and support in both directions.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair, I know you and your members of the committee are no strangers to the subject of opioid addiction and medically assisted treatment. Former Senator Fred Dyson of Eagle River and I talked about this almost ad nauseum to the Senate for the past decade or so about the growing problem of opioid addiction. And there are lots of drug problems out there. People self-medicate for a variety of legitimate and illegitimate reasons, I suppose. But opioid addiction has reached epidemic proportions here in the state and is a growing and deadly problem. Madam Chair, fatal drug overdoses has increased more than sixfold in the past three decades and now claims the lives of over 36,000 Americans every year. And specifically in Alaska, heroin use is back in epidemic numbers, and heroin-related overdoses are claiming more young lives than traffic fatalities, according to the Anchorage Police Department here in Alaska. That was a shocking information point for me. The 2014 Alaska State Troopers Drug Report identified an increase in heroin abuse and the continued use of other opiates as significant concerns for law enforcement. This abuse and overdose epidemic is largely driven by addiction to prescription opioids such as OxyContin, oxycodone, and Vicodin, which are very valuable pain relievers, but when abused, are really bad news. They've been harder to come by in recent years for a variety of reasons and therefore more expensive. So a lot of people get into younger people, especially get into their parents. If their dad's a veteran, has legitimate pain, pills, prescription drugs prescribed by the VA or other healthcare providers in a very legitimate legal way for pain reduction. Sometimes people overuse and abuse those opioids, and then when those opioids become too expensive, the pills become too expensive on the street, they convert to a cheaper alternative, which is heroin. Black tar heroin brought in by drug cartels, the black market, who are bringing in all kinds of serious drugs, but black tar heroin has reached epidemic proportions, and it's not just an Anchorage problem, Madam Chair. I know you have a statewide perspective, and thankfully so, but this is something that's affecting our entire state. Places you wouldn't think or hope that heroin and the drug cartels hadn't reached, but they have. The face of heroin is changing, and thank you for letting me put this on the record in support of the bill, Madam Chair. People tend to think of heroin abuse as a problem plaguing poor people or inner cities, but in the past decade, heroin abuse has exploded across Alaska and all across the United States to affluent suburbs and even rural communities across the state. So it's not just meth in rural areas, it's heroin. And it's hitting us particularly hard. Between 2006 and 2013, the number of first-time heroin users nearly doubled from 90,000 to 169,000, according to the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, with nearly 80% of heroin users saying that they previously abused prescription opioids, so that is the gateway. Madam Chair, heroin and other opioid abuse has reached epidemic levels in Alaska. Drug seizures, in our office, we have a notice when something comes up through Google reports, press reports, and it's the Kenai, the Valley, Fairbanks, it's every community you could possibly imagine has been touched. This trend is particularly troubling because prescription opioids are very popular among young Alaskans. According to 2011 data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 15.8% of Alaska students reported having used prescription pills without a prescription, making them more popular among high school students than alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana. Quite disturbing. Luckily, Madam Chair, opioid overdose is reversible through a timely administration of the medication naloxone and the provision of emergency care, yet it is often not available where and when it is needed, most because overdose often occurs when the victim is with friends and family, those people who may be best situated to save a life by administering naloxone. So that is the simple point of this bill. Madam Chair, medical professionals and first responders and others, family members, are wary of prescribing, and laypersons wary of administering opioid overdose drugs due to potential civil liability. We're not talking about criminal liability here, just civil liability. SB 23 removes that civil liability from a doctor who prescribes, so doctors are expressing support, and laypersons who administer naloxone, which is almost a miracle drug to reverse overdoses, in case of opioid overdose. In an attempt to reverse our opioid overdose epidemic, I hope Alaska will be the 29th state. So we're not plowing new ground. We're late to the party. It's not a party. It's a tragedy. It's a funeral, so to speak. But we would be the 29th state if we were to pass this legislation that is attracting good bipartisan support. So it's a relatively small bill. I know I almost hesitate to say a small bill or a simple bill. We should think deeply about even the simplest of legislation. But it can literally be the difference between life and death. SB 23 is, as I said, attracting bipartisan support, along with the support of the Alaska State Medical Association, very proud of that, the Alaska Police Department Employees Association, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and folks will be testifying briefly, the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center, and countless families and addicts, people just stepping forward in droves to express their support for this legislation. At the previous committee, the Senate HES Committee, Rick Sabodny testified in the difference between the civil liability and criminal liability and said that the Department of Law of this administration is supportive of the legislation. And, Madam Chair, as you know, it's oftentimes hard to get an administration or a new administration to take a position on a bill that's not in its final stage through the legislation. But the version before you does have the support of the Department of Law and the administration. So with that, Mr. or Madam Chair, my staffer, Matt Moser, in Amory Lee Lake's absence, is available to go more into depth about naloxone and walk the committee through the bill, whatever the committee prefers. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. I intend to add on as a co-sponsor to the bill, and I appreciate your leadership on this subject and the thorough overview that you gave us. So would you prefer to have questions directed then to Matt?
Sure.
Okay, excellent. If you want to go ahead and put yourself on the record. And
thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Moser, staff to Senator Johnny Ellis.
Excellent.
And if it pleases the committee, we can take some questions now, or I can walk through a sectional or go into a little bit more about naloxone.
Senator Coghill.
We have a CS.
Yes.
We want to go ahead and get that. I'm going to go through
please.
A sectional. That
might
Thank
be you very much. Yeah. So, Senator Coghill.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the E version for CS for Senate Bill 23 Judiciary, dated 3/27/15, as a document before us.
Excellent. Is there any objection to that motion?
I'll object just so that we can hear what the changes are.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator Costello. And I wanted to note that Senator Wilikowski joined us some time ago. So, Mr. Moser, if we could hear the changes in version E.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I could walk through the entire version E or just start with the changes. Does it make sense?
Start with the changes,
Great.
Please. Thank you.
Okay. So this is version E, and section 1, subsection D, and section 2, subsection D4, change the definition of opioid overdose program so that it is not limited to federal, state, or municipal-funded programs. So that added a new section. And section A authorizes healthcare providers to prescribe an opioid overdose drug directly or by standing order or protocol to a person who is at risk of experiencing an opioid overdose, or to a family member, friend, caregiver, or other person in a position to administer the drug to a person at risk of experiencing an overdose. And finally, subsection B, this is also section A, this authorizes an employee or volunteer of an opioid overdose program to receive a supply, possess, and provide opioid overdose drugs to persons at risk of experiencing an opioid overdose, or to a family member, friend, caregiver, or other person in position to administer the opioid overdose drug to a person at risk of experiencing an overdose.
Excellent.
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Costello. Questions from committee members. I want to start by saying it was interesting in preparation for this hearing. I did a little research because I remember my father, who's the physician, telling me that heroin at one point had been marketed by Bayer, a company called Bayer, as a treatment for opiate abuse. And so I was just researching it last night. Very interesting. It looks like it was in the 1870s, and a London physician added a couple molecules to the opiate, and it was developed and marketed later in the 1900s by a German subsidiary of Bayer. So it's just amazing, the history of it, and sad too, right? That would have been one we could have avoided inventing, I think. But my question is, in addition to the healthcare providers that are mentioned in here that would have an opportunity to have the naloxone, do the state troopers and local police, are they provided an opportunity to have that in their care kits? I just wanted to know a little bit about that. So they're often the first responders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question. And I guess I don't know specifically about state troopers, but it's a common part of the toolkit that our EMTs carry with them now. And
okay.
So this bill expands the opportunity. So the first responders in the cases of overdose are often family or friends. And so I suspect this would allow state troopers to also carry this, since they also are often the first responders on the scene.
Fantastic. Any questions? Yes, Senator Coghill.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for bringing this forward. This is new territory to me. I did not know that this existed. I'm glad that it does, and it sounds to me like it really does turn people around from the edge. probably my first question came up when I saw the at-risk. So I can understand if somebody's experiencing, but then the judgment call of at-risk, at what point, how broad is that, is be my question. And since we're in the Judiciary Committee and we're talking about liability, mm-hmm. it really is going to rest on the at-risk question, because I think administering it, if there's an overdose that you can tell for sure, is right. It's appropriate. But the at-risk then gives you a judgment call, probably necessary, I think, when you're using EMS. But now in training, what's the scope that you're going to be able to help us understand?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
To Senator Coghill, it's an excellent question, and that concern has been expressed before as well. And the good news is that it doesn't really matter that much, in that, you know, only a healthcare provider on scene could make a judgment about at risk. But the naloxone, if it's administered for someone who is not in overdose, it has no negative side effects. So you can administer it to someone who's not even under the threat of heroin overdose or opioid overdose from some other opioid, and it will not harm them. So that really allayed most of my fears, that it doesn't matter. Even if a healthy person receives naloxone, it will not have any kind of negative effect.
Well, Madam Chair, he did a good job. He answered both of my questions before I got to him.
Isn't that great? Yes, he's a veteran. Further questions for Senator Ellis or Mr. Moser from members of the committee? Okay, well, thank you very much. We have just one other person online. Whoops, I pushed the wrong thing. Okay, it's a technical difficulty.
Yes, another question?
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Somebody in the room as well.
Okay, great.
So, and this may be for you or somebody else in the room. Now, at this point, the next question is, how do I get training? What is the training that I'm going to get, and what does it look like? And I'm glad to know that probably, even if I mess it up, I'm not going to do harm. That's good news.
Yes.
And then, if I'm going to be trained, you know, what are some of the things I need to watch out for?
For the record, Matt Moser, staff to Senator Ellison. Thank you for that question, Senator Coghill. In other states, the training programs have actually been pretty simple and straightforward. There's been some ground plowed in this area in the administration of EpiPens for allergic reactions, and studies have found that laypersons or citizens are able to administer those drugs safely. And so the training in terms of the naloxone involves training a layperson in terms of administering an injection for the drug, or it's also available in a nasal spray. So the layperson would learn how to administer either of those two options to a person, and also not diagnose, but be aware of what the signs of symptoms of an overdose are.
And Madam Chair, just a little more detail. When a doctor prescribes the EpiPen with naloxone to the parent or the loved one or to the addict, that's when they can give the prescription, and it's on the EpiPen, the injection instructions. So that's basically when the training would occur. And I would just point out something that Senator Dyson, and it's part of this is a tribute to Senator Dyson, he and I would point out the gross underfunding of the methadone clinics in Fairbanks and Anchorage that we've sort of ignored. Nobody wants to delve into the world of heroin abuse, but these are people's children and grandchildren and loved ones, brothers and sisters, and they're long waiting lists. And if you remember years ago, we put pregnant women at the top of the list.
Yeah.
And then we found out that some women were going out purposefully to become pregnant so they could go to the top of the list to get treatment for opioid addiction. It was just very twisted. But those programs are underfunded, and especially so in light of this epidemic. And there are parents that I've heard from. They don't want to come and testify. They don't want their names used, obviously. People that have their teenage son or daughter sort of confined to the basement of a home because they can't get methadone to go to the clinic, and methadone isn't the preferred treatment anymore.
Uh-huh.
prescription drugs or chemistry moves on in science, but it's the best we have now in terms of remedial treatment in the short term. But there are parents who can't get their kids on treatment or don't have health insurance. Another debate for another day. But parents that would want to be able to save a loved one's life with this easily administered, easily trained prescription drug that doctors can train you in prescribing.
Yes, Senator Klugman.
Thank you, Senator. You've done some good homework on this, and I'm really grateful for that. Just practically speaking, then, how do I go to a doctor or a pharmacist and say, I need this? Do I have to bring in somebody who's dragging their feet, or do I have some reasonable request that can be brought to them?
Thank you, through the Chair, Senator Congill, Matt Moser, for the record. I guess, you know, we're still learning about what this might look like in Alaska, and I just have some information about what's been done in other states. And just briefly, there around the country, there's 188 programs throughout 15 different states in D.C. Mm-hmm. That have distributed naloxone to 53,000 people, and they report more than 10,000 successful overdoses. And there's a study in particular, and we'll get this in the record for the committee, but in Massachusetts, they had reported about 2,000 overdose reversals. And so I think there that's a very good question in terms of what the doctor's discretion would be in terms of prescribing this to convince them that there's a, you know, you or a family member needs this. And so I suspect, you know, this bill removes the civil liability so that you would need to make the case to the doctor and they would have to use their discretion to prescribe it. So it would be available for prescription through a doctor, or opioid overdose reversal programs are included in this legislation also.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. And question, have you guys been, we had a briefing here in this committee, it's been about 2 months ago now, on Vivitrol. And I wondered if you've been briefed on that particular drug and its ability through a shot in a 30-day kind of bonding to the molecules to help with opiate addiction.
For the record, Matt Moser, Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with that, but I think it there is a trend, or you know, science and the medical community are really seeing this major problem and coming up with different tools to address it, and that certainly sounds like a promising tool in terms of addressing the addiction itself, not just saving lives. And on that point, just briefly,
Ms. Lake is an expert, and we can follow up with you.
Yeah, I would love that. Okay, that's great. Well, I just to dovetail into, you know, the overarching picture, this is one part of it, the civil liability for those who are at that immediate point where they can save the life. That's excellent. So supportive of the bill. But just thinking about this bigger picture that you've raised, you and Senator Dyson, about the rising use of heroin, and it has been about a decade, you've been telling us, and now it's statewide and so forth. But we had an interesting presentation, and now my understanding is they're looking at a grant. It's a $1 million grant that they're looking at putting in here in Alaska that might, as you said, prevent or treat opiate addiction. So just wanted to put that on the record as well.
And Madam Chair, there was an interest by former Governor Parnell about, and the drug manufacturers had come to Alaska and talked about Vivitrol and the promise of that chemistry and that prescription drug. And I think a few people thought, well, we could get rid of all the funding for the Fairbanks and Anchorage methadone clinics, which it's not very much money.
Right.
It goes a long way with folks, though it's, you know, there's a long waiting list. We can't, it's not a substitute immediately, but the longer term, you are absolutely right. The Vivitrol holds a lot of promise for the future. And there is a doctor in the Matsu Valley prescribing the Vivitrol within his practice. So that is sort of a bridge to the future, but we're not quite there yet.
Excellent. And particularly interesting to me was the idea that someone who had been admitted to corrections who had an opiate addiction could get that shot on their final day of serving their sentence, so that when they go out, they're not met by their drug dealer at the end of the road, that they've got 30 days worth of some immunity on board.
Prophylactic protection.
Yes.
That's, Madam Chair, that's exactly what happens.
Yeah.
Because of lack of treatment in the prisons or in the community.
Yep.
They go back, and the drug dealer, almost at the gate, right off the state property, at the sixth, at the Cook Inlet pretrial or the other jail facility.
Yeah, it's devastating. Well, good. Any further questions then? Here we do. We're back online with Randall Burns, and then we have Kate Burkhart here in the room. Kate. So, Kate, why don't we go to you first, and then we'll go to Randall Burns. Thank you, Senator Ellis, and thank you, Mr. Moser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kate Burkhart. I am the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the State Planning Council for Substance Abuse Issues, as well as the Alaska Mental Health Board. My comments today are on behalf of those boards and none other. The boards expressly support SB 23 and the committee substitute before you. This bill speaks directly to constituent concerns that were raised with the board late last summer. Those concerns came from physicians engaged in medication-assisted treatment, using medications like Vivitrol and buprenorphine and others to help people achieve sobriety and recovery. So my comments are going to be focused on that population. When you are engaged in treatment for addiction and you are on the road to recovery and sobriety, it is expected that you will relapse. It's just a matter of course. For folks that are in treatment for opiate addictions, a relapse can be life-threatening because if they use at the same level they were using when they entered treatment, because their tolerance is reduced because of a long period of abstinence and sobriety, their body reacts negatively and they overdose. The constituent concerns brought to us by these physicians was whether it was permissible and within their professional ethics to prescribe this medication. From their perspective, it was protecting the life of their patient because a relapse is a reasonable expectation. However, there was concern that they would be seen as promoting illicit drug use. The board reached out to the state medical board for express guidance for these physicians. Absent express guidance from the state medical board, SB 23 provides the guidance that these physicians were looking for so that they understand that it is within the scope of practice to take care of their patients. In previous conversation this afternoon, there was conversation about folks leaving the correction system. This is exactly the same situation they are in, often without the support of a treatment provider. They've had a period of abstinence while they were in the custody of the Department of Corrections, and then when they are released, if they attempt to use at the same level before they went into prison, the likelihood of an overdose is far greater. Ensuring that their family members have the ability to treat them immediately while they're waiting for an ambulance will save their life. On the question of how do we know who's at risk and who to prescribe to, that is within the physician's scope of practice, just like with any other medication. And so whether it's a physician who is treating someone actively for opiate addiction, or a physician, a primary care physician, who knows that their patient is struggling with an opiate addiction and is awaiting treatment, or we're trying to build their readiness for treatment, it's the opportunity to ensure that they don't die before they get on the road to recovery. And so the boards are extremely grateful for the fact that this bill is before you so quickly after it was raised by the physicians who are working with these folks on a daily basis. Thank you.
Excellent questions. Thank you, Ms. Burkhart. And so we have one other person, Randall Burns.
And Madam Chair,
yes,
Senator Ellis. Juno person in the room.
Oh, my apologies. Okay, we'll go to Randall Burns, and then we'll come right back to you. Okay, Mr. Burns, sorry we lost you briefly.
Not a problem, Madam Chair. My name, for the record, my name is Randall Burns with the Division of Behavioral Health. I actually, I'm just on the phone to answer any questions. I didn't have any additional comments on the bill.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Burns? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, then we have Karen Nelson. Ms. Nelson? Welcome.
I am trying to do this without crying this time. First of all, thank you for having this opportunity to talk about this issue. I mean, there's so many issues going on around it, but this particular bill, SB 23, it really is about saving lives, even one life. And I shared at the last time I was here testifying on this bill about my own experience, and just listening to kind of what was everyone said here, and I don't know if there's a time limit, so I really have to watch myself.
You're fine. But would you do me a favor? Just, we know who you are, but if you just put your name on the record and any affiliation, you have Haven House here.
Okay.
If you just put that
My name's Kara Nelson, K-A-R-A-N-E-L-S-O-N, and I am the director of Haven House Juno. I'm also on the executive committee of the Juno Reentry Coalition, and I also chair the peer work group for the coalition and also the Juno Recovery Community.
Thank you.
So I'm going to briefly just tell my experience and then kind of what I don't know. I didn't know what I was going to say. So I, it's by God's grace I'm sitting here alive, clean and sober, and I have OD'd twice. The first time I was left. And saying those words, I mean, when I hear it, last time when I testified, I didn't realize how much it would hit me, because we learned to just like it's not a big deal, and it's a big deal. And I died, you know. I was 19 at the time, and I grew up in Alaska my whole life, logging camps, mostly in Ketchikan as well. So I was in Tacoma, Washington at that time. But, you know, what I'd like to say about that is I was left because of the fear of, you know, getting in trouble. And plus, what I'd like to just remind everyone is when people are living in active addiction, you're thinking of it from the same mind. We're not thinking that way, you know. We are completely taken over. And I know it's hard to understand that. And I've had to deal with it with my own children as well. And so I've seen it from all sides, and my parents, who dealt with me in not just an active addiction, but, you know, everything that comes with that. And our whole family was just torn upside down. And then, of course, it ended up going to prison and having two drug felonies. I mean, I have several. Today, I use my court view as like a resume, which is funny because it's pretty long, and it's all drug-related and substance use-related and domestic assaults, and making those decisions based on my worth. You know, I grew up in a great family, and my parents are still together. I mean, I went to Clover Pass Christian School. I only knew great families, and so addiction has no face. There's no stereotype. And recovery also has no face, you know, neither discriminates. And so when I hear, and I've been at a lot of meetings, you know, when I see corrections or Department of Health and Social Services, I just come, you know, because being the director of Haven House has been so in my face that there needs to be this shame and stigma needs to be taken care of on the community level, because everyone can say, yeah, we want to help people. Yeah, this is a big deal. When I read the newspapers the other day, I just read in Anchorage, I can't think right now, but I think it was like 30 shootings or something. I mean, and 10 out of 10 of those were drug related. So really the bottom level here is bringing out long-term recovery, not counting on short-term treatments, not counting on throwing every person that has substance use disorders and mental health issues in jail, and then when they're not cooperating, throw them in, you know, then they're in more trouble, and so then we get out, we have felonies now. That label trumps everything. and this is getting way off subject, sorry, okay, I'll get back to SB 23, but it's just this, all of this matters, even though some people think, oh, that just, like, how do you know when someone, first of all, there is a group of people right here in Juneau, my friends. We have a passion for this, you know, and someday we will have a recovery community center. And that's when people come in and have training and things like that. I have mentors who do this training. It's very simple, very comprehensive. I talk to them all the time. I was hoping actually he could call in for this. John Schinholzer, he's the founder of McShin Foundation Virginia.
Okay.
I was just in St. Louis at this amazing summit where I got to speak with the not Michael Botticelli, but his director, you know, of the Office of Drug Policy Control. I'm not saying that right either. But, you know, and so here we are. We're not paid to do this, although that would be nice, you know, but because we have a passion, we are speaking out about Narcan and about saving one life matters. I wouldn't be here today. My kids wouldn't be here today. They're beautiful. My daughter's graduating this week. They've been through all the collateral consequences. Those innocent kids not only had parents that were very sick and living in active addiction, but then were told they were criminals and they were better off without them and that I chose drugs over them. And I didn't have treatment to go to.
Yeah.
If I did, I would have probably waited months to get in. By then, I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to do my jail time.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so much to this, but it's not undoable. I mean, it's not doable. It really, this is a huge step right here in really building trust with the family members who don't know what to do. My parents didn't know what to do. When I went to prison, they had to take my children. I'm fortunate that was there. You know, they didn't have the financial means. They weren't in foster care, so they couldn't get any help, you know. My kids, of course, were devastated, so all these things were going on, and there was no support. They knew nothing about the drug world or anything. My dad now is the chaplain of Lemon Creek Correctional Center, and 5 years ago, he wouldn't even talk to a felon. And so,
wow.
Like, this story is so huge, and it's not just me or my family. Like, there's so many amazing people right here in our city. And we, like, want to be excited about these different things finally happening, but it's just, like, there's so much more that could happen right now. Like, having, we live this. You know, we don't need to bring in experts telling you and spending thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars to tell you why people are recidivating. Like, ask us, I'll tell you in 5 minutes, and I won't charge you. And so then, of course, we have to learn the system and how to speak in that way, and that's very difficult, but
you're doing great.
I feel like after years now, I mean, opening Haven House was huge, even though we still have an appeal on the 13th, because that kind of, I know it, you know, it's legitimate fears at one point, and then there's education, and then that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable to treat your own Alaskan women as less than second-class citizens, people you haven't even met. This woman that just moved in, she's amazing. We look at those signs that are still in front of our house today, right now, and it's an inspiration to show them who we really are, because this idea of what a felon is after, I mean, it's just not the same as it was, you know, 40 years ago. My kids have been through hell. I mean, who cares about my story? Yes, everyone's like, oh, you're doing, you know, you're great and all this. And it's just like, no, you know, it's all the people that get wrapped up in that cycle. There's not one person, I don't think, in the state that hasn't been affected by drugs and alcohol. And we are the number one we have the number one suicide numbers.
Yep.
I'm sure a lot of that is related to alcohol and drug use, sexual assault, domestic violence, homelessness, poverty. I have lived experience in all of that, and they're all being, like, piecemealed out or something. Like, why aren't we just focusing on the community level, ground level of long-term recovery? Narcan, that one life saved, it's not going to do any good if they go back to a community that isn't recovery-friendly.
Exactly.
This is not a recovery-friendly community. I'm sorry. I love Juneau. I love my state. It is. There's a lot of good things going on, but from what I see on the ground level when I go into the prison, which I do every week, somehow, because I'm a felon, I don't know how that happened, but that peer support is more powerful than anything. And we're not just a cute little story to put in the newspaper about redemption. We have a voice that matters, and we're not going to be silent anymore. We've put that shame on ourselves by hiding, you know, and we've done that too. So we're honored to take on the job of just being the people that really stand up and unashamed and just do this thing. Because regardless if we get help or not, or if, you know, people are going to jail for using Narcan, which is insane, and that's just insanity, we're going to recover. We're going to do this, whether we have help or not, because that's what we do. And so I would just say, always remember to, when I was listening about, you know, who's going to administer this or the doctors, like, I don't picture it like that. That's not how I see it. I mean, if, of course, if we had a center, that would be perfect. But, I mean, this is more on a grassroots level of, I know the way the McShin Foundation does it, and Honesty, she's a good friend of mine. She just did a training a couple days ago, and it's very simple. And we would love to do something like that. I mean, giving back to the communities that we've taken from, that we've created chaos in, and believe me, I did. I know I look so innocent right now, but I just, recovery is so different than active addiction. And I still get treated like I'm still in active addiction. And I still will have those felonies for the rest of my life. And my children will still have to deal with my stuff for the rest of their life. And they're, you know, they're also, I mean, just because they watch me, you know, they come out a little more like, okay. But they were teenagers. We were thrown into a situation, you know, that was uncomfortable and awkward at that age, and then their mom getting out of prison, their dad's still in prison. But, you know, so there's so much to this. Let's start at the ground level. But right now, let's save the lives. Yeah. But realize, like, Vivitrol, great product, but it needs to be surrounded with recovery-orientated systems of care. It has to be. These things are already being done in other states. It's not like reinventing the wheel. People are doing it. SAMHSA has tons of grants supporting this.
Okay.
Tons. I also got to meet the director of SAMHSA last week. It was awesome. But, I mean, that's the kind of places I find myself in, because it's just recovery is contagious. So is addiction.
Good.
You know what I mean? So I really appreciate everything that's being done. It's really exciting. I try and, like, balance myself out because, you know, we want everything right now. But I just would like to say we would do the training. I know the people are already doing it. They're all certified and all that good stuff. And we actually are also certified recovery coaches. We go into prison as reentry coaches and so forth. Sorry.
We'll get you, Amy, you want to get her a glass of water?
So, I mean, I could go on. Well, I'll just stop there.
Thank you, Kara. And, you know, Ms. Nelson, we will love to hear from you more in the future, too.
Yeah.
I, first of all, want to say thank you. I always really appreciate the personal Alaskan stories, and this committee elicits that. It's the subject matter in the Senate Judiciary Committee elicits a lot of really brave testimony and stories from Alaskans, and I want to thank you for coming forward today. You did perfectly. There's no right way to do it, but the most important thing is getting your voice heard, and the fact that there will be people watching you that will be inspired by the fact that you have come forward today, that you are in recovery, and that you're willing to talk about it. And I agree that there's a culture that has been built up of shame around the diseases of drug and alcohol addiction. And it's something that we're working on collectively as policymakers. Senator Ellis behind you, Senator Coghill to my left, Senator Dyson have been early leaders in trying to change the way that we view the culture. It is a disease, and unfortunately we've looked at it more as a criminal model. And And so we're trying to change the way that we look at that from a financing point of view, from a humanitarian point of view, from all of those aspects. And our committee is committed to working on that over the next 2 years. So we look forward to having you be a part of our team and more dialogue with you, because clearly your expertise surround a lot of other areas, not just this response, this civil liability issue today, but the issue of what happens when somebody is cited for a drug-related crime, and what is the best way to treat their children, and what's the best way to put them into recovery, what are the resources. So I thank you today for coming forward. I've been to Haven House. You gave me a tour. I appreciate what you're doing there. It's amazing what you and the women of Haven House are doing for the future women that are out there, and the children. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I don't know if there are any other comments or questions.
Just thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. Is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 23? Is there anyone else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we have the bill back before us for discussion. Senator Coghill.
One more question, if I could maybe,
yes.
I can get the sponsor. Just want to know, and for the record, on page 3 of the line bill, of the bill, under the opioid drug section 2, basically, we're saying that a doctor may prescribe, and then there are three ways to describe it, and I just want to make sure I understand all three of these. So it's on page 3, line 2 and 3. And yes. So you can do it, can prescribe an opioid overdose drug directly by standing order or protocol to a person at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question I have is the protocol to a person at risk. How does that look? So you have somebody who has been hooked on drugs. Is that right? And then he comes and says, or she comes and says, you know, I'm trying to get off this, but I need to have this around the house. Is that what we're looking at here?
Yes.
For the record, Matt Moser, staff to Senator Ellis, Senator Coghill through the chair. That is my understanding. I believe the standing order protocol can also relate to perhaps a pharmacist who has authority from a physician.
Okay.
To also prescribe that. And I wonder if Ms. Burkhart might be able to provide a better answer than that.
Excellent. Ms. Burkhart, come forward. And just to say on the record, we're getting, you know, later in the session, I vetted this bill. I'm prepared to move it out today, but I want to be sure that members have all their questions answered. It has had other hearings, and it's got another stop here to go. So I'd like to get it out if we can answer the questions.
Yeah, I'm not trying to slow down.
No, I know that. And I just want to be sure that you're comfortable is, I guess, right. What I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
For the record, Kate Burkhart, Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Senator Coghill through the chair. My reading of the portion of the bill that you've referenced is that either a physician, I'll use myself as an example,
okay.
As a hypothetical example. So I could go to my primary care provider and explain that I am addicted to an opiate and I am awaiting treatment and I'm a little scared about what's going to happen. The doctor could prescribe this medication so that my spouse or parent could save me if the time came. The standing order or protocol would allow the medical director of a treatment program to have a standing order that all patients of the treatment program that are receiving treatment for opiate addiction receive this prescription. So I think that there's a difference. There could be either standing orders through a healthcare organization or a treatment program, or you're also allowing a physician to have the confidence in a one-on-one relationship.
Yeah, thank you. My first question on the safety of the issue, and Senator Ellis answered that the downside to this is you could still administer it and there's no harm done, so yeah. With all of that. But I just wanted to know, those are some of the questions I picked out as I was reading through it. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Matt or Kate. So the civil liabilities are not removed for the untrained bystander. The way I read it, it sounds like if you're trained, that this bill addresses you. But if you're untrained, essentially line page 2, line 13.
Yes, Senator Costello, through the chair, that is my reading at that subsection B2 states that the person must receive education and training in the proper emergency use and administration. So that is a required component of administering the drug.
And just to add, Kate Burkhart, Senator Costello through the chair, I think the anticipated training is very similar to patient education that you receive for other medications, and the EpiPen for allergic reactions has been referenced this afternoon. I don't think that we're contemplating sending all the parents to some big hoo-ha training. I think it's the doctor says, when Kate needs this, this is how you administer it.
Okay, yes, Senator Costello.
The situation I was envisioning is somebody is just a bystander who hasn't received training and they want to use it, and that person's not protected by this bill.
I'm not sure how a bystander would have the medication.
Well, I don't know. They could.
It seems like if it's possible that it might be on the person, and I mean, I'm just envisioning some of the scenarios that could occur.
Within a user group, perhaps? I don't know.
Thank you, Senator Costello, through the chair. I believe that reading is correct. The exemption from liability doesn't apply in cases of gross negligence or reckless or intentional misconduct. But the civil liability is extended, in this bill to the both the prescriber, the doctors, and someone who has received the training to administer the drug. So that's my understanding as well. Madam Chair, could I add just one thing for the record in terms of the safety of this drug? I know other states have been across the country have been removing civil liability, and it was interesting for me to hear in Italy this drug has been available over the counter without a prescription since the 1990s, and there has been no reported overdoses or misuses. But I think that speaks a little bit to the safety and usability of this by people who aren't necessarily medical professionals.
That's a really excellent thing to have on the record. There's our FDA, there's lots of issues there. We could have a whole couple weeks of hearings on that. So that's a good goal for the future, because I think Senator Costello brings up an interesting point, and maybe that's for a future iteration. We're just looking at this as a new drug, and great questions about can it be misused and what are the side effects. But I think her point is a good one, which is that if it is over-the-counter in Italy and you did happen to have it on your person and there was somebody overdosing and you administered it, you might want that protection to extend. So this is a first step as we're getting to understand the drug and the protocol, and maybe we'll reach a point where it's more accessible to the public. The other thing I read about heroin that was just awful, but is that about 93% of it's imported into the United States from Afghanistan. And when I think about where our efforts are put, I hope that we spend more of it on stopping the importation of that drug and the people who are dealing it, as opposed to the people who become addicted to it in the disease model. But that's just something for the record. Anything further that members have? I'd take a motion if people are ready. Senator Coghill.
Madam Chair, I'm ready. I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill 23 Judiciary from committee with individual recommendations, and I think there's a zero fiscal note.
Yes, there is. Okay, is there an objection to the motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then Senate Bill 23 will move out of Senate Judiciary with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our best to Amory. Okay, so next we have one of my bills. Yes? Oh, we'll take an Eddie's. And put HCR 3 ahead of a Senate bill Senate Bill 82. So we have the bill's sponsor's representative, Mr. Wright, and then we have Representative Heron, who's going to be offering an amendment through us. Welcome.
It's always a pleasure to appear before this committee. I don't get to do it often enough, and it's always an enjoyable experience.
Thank you. Well, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Wright, Chief of Staff to Speaker Chenault. Is this thing on? It sounds...
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure. HCR3 is a pretty basic resolution. There's a lot of words in there, but what it does is urge the governor and the attorney general to pursue all legal and legislative options to open the coastal plain of the Arctic Wildlife or National Wildlife Refuge areas and areas of the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas oil and gas exploration, development, and production. The resolution's in response to actions taken by the Obama administration that request Congress to designate the coastal plain of Anwar as wilderness and then designated 9.8 million acres in the waters of the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas off our coast as off-limits to consideration for future oil and gas leasing. As most of you are aware, the Alaska Statehood Act recognized the need for resource development to ensure our economic viability, and Section 6I of the Act ensured that the state would have the right to minerals on land received from the federal government, and 30 U.S.C. 191 provides for the sharing of federal royalties with the state from federal lands in the state.
Excellent. Questions for Mr. Wright? It's a great resolution. We certainly appreciate you bringing it forward. It's very timely with all of the assaults that we've been facing, from the Arctic policy to the edict regarding ANWR and all those things. So I appreciate the resolution. If there's nothing, no further questions for the bill's sponsor's representative, then we'll have Representative Heron come forward. We're making procedural allowances for my co-chair of the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission. Members should have in their packet H1 that is an amendment that we will label amendment number one, and I'll go ahead and make a move amendment number one, and I'd appreciate an objection so that we can have it explained to us. So I move amendment number one.
And I'll object so we can hear it.
Thank you. So Representative Heron.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this opportunity before you on proposing or providing information on this this Senate Judiciary Amendment. It's come to our attention very recently, near the start of session, that there is a new federal code phrase for wilderness, and they call it landscape characteristics. And so I just, by adding this amendment to this resolution, people become familiar when we hear our federal counterparts talk about landscape characteristics and what is that definition. So that we just recently learned. It's used by especially the Wildlife Service. The other part of the proposed resolve is that the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee has the ability to, of course, enter into contracts with individuals that could help Alaska.
Yes.
And the governor. And so essentially, it was proven that Senator McGuire and myself and other committee members of the commission found that it's difficult for commissions and even legislative committees to work effectively, I guess, in working with our federal governments. And so we'd like to see how give the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee the authority to hire the right people to assist us.
Excellent. Okay, questions on amendment number one? You want to remove your objection?
Yeah, I'll remove my objection. I like this one.
Yeah, this is a good one. Okay, we thank you for bringing that forward and flagging one of the other terms of art. I thought we'd flagged as many of them as we could in our Arctic policy, but there's a new one, so certainly appreciate it. So amendment number one is adopted. That brings HCR 3 as amended back before our committee. Is there anyone here in the audience that wishes to testify on the committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution Number 3? Anyone online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then we'll close public testimony. That brings the resolution back before us. Is there a motion?
And Madam Chair, I move that we move the CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 3 rules from committee as amended with individual recommendations.
Excellent. Any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, the CS for House Concurrent Resolution Number 3 as amended with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note will move out of Senate Judiciary. Thank you. Okay, next we will go then to Senate Bill 82. And we have Genevieve Watusik from our team to tell us about it. And welcome, Genevieve, if you just put yourself on the record. Genevieve has been at the hospital with Amory, so she's doing double duty today. That's what we do around here in our legislative family. So thank you, Genevieve.
Thank you. For the record, Genevieve Watusik, staff to Senator McGuire. In front of you, you have Senate Bill 82, an act relating to mitigating factors at sentencing. It is just a paragraph bill, but it's very important to us. It's saying that a judge can allow the 24/7 sobriety program as a factor if a person decides to go into that on their own just when they're going into the sentencing. They don't have to use that as a factor, but they can, and this just allows that. And at a time period when we're in a budget deficit and it costs over $140 a day to house an inmate, this program is less than $30 a day. It's $10 for a urine analysis. It's $250 for a breathalyzer, and that's twice a day, so $5 a day for a breathalyzer, $10 a day for a urine analysis, and to test remotely, it's $10 to $12 a day as well. So it's a very cost-effective program. And we have some people online to testify on this, and we have 2-0 fiscal notes from Hess and from the courts, so we're pretty supportive of it.
Thank you, Ms. Watusik, for bringing this forward. And if there are questions, are there any questions for Ms. Watusik at this time? If not, I'm going to go to, we have three folks online. Bill Mickelson, who is the developer of the 24/7 sobriety program. He's calling from South Dakota. We have Tony Piper, who's with the Department of Health and Social Services, the ASAP program that we know about. And then Dennis Johnson. We also know Dennis. He's with Alaska Pretrial Services. So any questions for Ms. Watusik at this time? You'd stick around for us. Be great. Okay, I'm going to go to Bill Mickelson, knowing, Mr. Mickelson, that you are in South Dakota, and there's a time difference, and we appreciate you being online. If you'd go ahead and state your name and your affiliation on the record and tell us a little bit about, most of us do know about the Sobriety 24/7 program, but put some more on the record about it and why you support Senate Bill 82, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Bill Mickelson. I'm a 43-year veteran of law enforcement here in South Dakota, and it was with my tenure with the Attorney General that developed, implemented, and directed the 24/7 sobriety program until my retirement. The 24/7 sobriety program has been operating for about 11 years now in South Dakota and successfully migrating across the country. And my task right now is that migration across the United States 24/7 in other states, and I've been in Alaska several times visiting with legislators and officials about the program. We have long held, regarding Senate Bill 782, we have long held that along with the discipline of the program that 24/7 sobriety brings, there needs to be a reward for successful participation in the program. And so Senate Bill 82 is just spot on with our philosophy and rewarding people for their successful participation in 24/7.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Mickelson, and perhaps it'll spur an idea for states that have aggravators and mitigators and maybe catch on. It's something that just stuck out there for us as a committee as one of those glaring areas that, you know, that people were voluntarily entering into it, and we really appreciate that, and that they're going through the program. It's a savings to the state. It's a savings to our community, our civilization, their families, all the heartache that comes from addiction, and that there could be an opportunity for a judge to mitigate their sentencing if that were the case. And so, and we appreciate Wendy Chamberlain also on your behalf bringing it forward to us, and thank you for all your work. Are there questions for Mr. Mickelson? Okay, then we will go to Dennis Johnson. Dennis, are you there? If you put your name on the record and tell us about your support for Senate Bill 82.
Yes, Senator McGuire. I have tremendous support for Senate Bill 82. I thank your office for bringing it forward, and I thank Genevieve for working with us on it. The 24/7 program has really been revolutionary to our pretrial and to our criminal justice system since it's been implemented in the fourth quarter of 2014. And I'll just give you a quick story so that you guys can understand. We had a young man that came on to the program, and I think that this defines why this bill is so crucial. And this young man came on the program onto 24/7. He was homeless. He was jobless. And he was picked up on a probation PTRP, and he provided a dirty UA to probation. He came on to the 24/7 program, and he was living at the Brother Francis shelter. He was taking a bus or walking every day to the east side location, which is on Turpin and DeBar from downtown Anchorage. He would make it every morning between 6 and 10 a.m. and do his PBT test. And he would make it every night between 5 and 9 p.m. and do his PBT test. In addition, he was required to do 3 UAs a week. So he was coming in 3 random days a week to do his UA. This individual remained clean on the program for 4.5, almost 5 months. And during that time, he worked with our social services department that we have for our electronic monitoring program. And we discovered that the man had a master's degree in the culinary arts, and he had a minor's degree in kitchen management. We were able to connect him with one of our resources here in town, one of the locally owned restaurants, and he started out washing dishes. And over the course of about 2.5 months, he moved from the dishwasher to the chief night cook. We were able to get him into some housing, and his probation was recommending 90 days incarceration for the dirty UA. The individual went to his sentencing and wanted to talk to the judge and say, "Look, Your Honor, I agree and I take ownership of my dirty UA, but this is what I've accomplished while I've been out of custody." Because Senate Bill 82 was not in effect, because there was no way for the judge to give him credit for the time that this young man did for obtaining full-time employment, becoming a productive member of society, getting housing, this individual is sentenced to 90 days incarceration and $158 a day. He lost his job, and he was released, should have been released homeless because he wouldn't have been able to pay his rent. We were able to find some folks who understood, and actually they came forward and they paid a month and a half of his rent. Other participants and officers here at Alaska Pretrial to help him with his rent. And we talked to his employer, and he's back to that employer. He's out now. But in the absence of Senate Bill 82, what we're doing is for naught. Because these guys, we're asking them to change. We're asking them to change their behavior, to be clean and sober, to work towards that. And then there's nothing at the end for them to get credit for it. And I encourage and I implore Senate members to take a hard look at this. We took a man who was out of custody for $5 a day doing alcohol testing and $30 a week, 3 UAs a week. So his bill is $65 a week. And we put him back into custody at $158 a day. And we took a bed up of somebody who could have used that bed that was a violent offender. If we're looking for ways to reduce bed space, if we're looking for ways to change our prison system so we don't have to build another $350 million prison in 2 years, this is how we do it. Senate Bill 82. In the month of March, we just closed our numbers out. The 24/7 program did 6,534 PBT tests. That's in Anchorage alone. That doesn't include Fairbanks, and that doesn't include Kenai. We did 791 drug UAs. Of the alcohol tests that we did, we had 3 alcohol fails. Wow. That's 3 alcohol fails in 6,000. 1,544 PBT tests, and we had two UA fails out of 791 UAs administered. That is reducing recidivism at its very fundamental basis. This program is working. This program is successful. Members of the Senate, I encourage you to support Senate Bill 62 to move or 82 and to move it forward, because these offenders that are doing what we're asking them to do, not drink, not use drugs, not reoffend, are doing it. And we need to give something that helps clear our prisons, reduce bed space, and give our judicial officers the opportunity to reward these guys and give them credit where credit is due. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, and thank you for, you know, you're one of those business people in my community that actually crosses over into public service as well. You really believe in your mission, and I remember the first time that you came before us years ago with these ideas. I've come out, I've seen Alaska Pretrial Services. I'm going to make sure that all members of the committee get a chance to come out and see what you do, and I thank you very much for what you've brought to our community. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, I just want to associate myself with those remarks, Senator McGuire. And Dennis, your personal story is really an amazing one. You've been before our committee a number of times. You've given us really tremendous guidance over the years. And I just can't say enough how much we appreciate all you're doing for our community, and you're helping make us safer and helping us save money at the same time. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Any further questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you, Dennis. Okay, next we'll go to Tony Piper. And Tony, you're on here as questions only. Is there any testimony that you'd like to offer? Is the department taking a position on Senate Bill 82?
This is Tony Piper. I'm with the Alcohol Safety Action Program, Madam Chair. I really am just to answer questions. And I'm not sure if the department has a stand on it, but I know the department does think that the program is working. And I can echo what Dennis says. This takes some work for people, and there's an investment that they make to be successful in this program, and it seems logical that they would get some benefit in the sentencing as well. So that's all I can say.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Piper? Okay, is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 82 that has not? Anyone online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 82 and bring the bill back before us for a motion. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that we move from committee the Senate Bill 82 with individual recommendations, and I think there's two fiscal notes, zero.
Yes, that's correct. Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we will move Senate Bill 82 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes out of this committee and on to the Senate Finance Committee. Is there anything further from members? Just stay and sign the reports. With that, we're adjourned.